The last Comanche to operate on Texas soil was Chief Muttuck, and in those final days at the canyons, he had with him an extraordinary ally, the old Comanchero Amos Peavine. For the rattlesnake, always aware that in troubled times he stood a chance to make a dollar, had slipped through the army forces, moving in from New Mexico with three large wagon loads of guns stolen from the depots of Kevin and Clark. The word stolen, when so used, covered a horde of possibilities. After investigations were completed, it seemed likely that CNC personnel had sold the illegal weapons to Peavine. Or, as another investigator suggested, the rattlesnake stole not only the guns, but also two CNC drivers who believed that by working with him they could earn a good deal more than the company paid them. At any rate, Rattlesnake Peavine had come down the rocky trails of Palo Duro some 2 weeks ahead of the army. But once there, with his guns sold and his Mexican gold pieces safely stowed, he realized that this time the encircling force of blueclads was so powerful escape was unlikely. He therefore started to build a close friendship with four white girls, 13 to 16, held by Matark's men. And he became extremely kind to them, giving them most of his food allotment, and protecting them from the torments of the young braves. After the first huge defections, Peavine strongly recommended that Matark and his remnant also surrender and find their home on the reservations north of the Red River. But the Comanche spoke for his men when he replied, "I live on no reservation." But the time came when pressure from the north made it imperative that Matark find temporary refuge by moving south, and he did this with such skill that he evaded Colonel Mackenzie's men pressing north. This placed him south of Palo Duro, down where the Panhandle joins the rest of Texas, and here he roamed and pillaged. The great Indian tribes had once covered the land called Texas, from the Gulf of Mexico to the mountains of the far west, from the Red River in the north to the Rio Grande in the south. And now they were diminished to this handful of Comanche under Matark and a few Apache who would soon be driven into the arid wastes of Arizona. It would fall to Matark to make the last stand. Scouts quickly informed Mackenzie that Matark was running wild to the south, so he dispatched Reed and the Fort Garner men to capture the raiders. And as winter approached, a great chase developed across the northern plains. Matark and Peavine would strike an exposed ranch, and Reed and Jaxifer would pursue them. Matark would make a long swing to the west, and Reed would cannily move northwest to intercept him in that unexpected quarter. But Peavine would warn his Comanche that this might be Reed's strategy, so they would move off in the opposite direction. But now the Indians were up against a man of both skill and endurance, and he led battle-hardened cavalry units. Slowly, but remorselessly, Reed closed in on these raiding Indians, edging them always closer to the southern rim of Palo Duro, where Mackenzie's superior numbers would annihilate them. The final battle that Reed envisaged did not occur, for a daring move by Jaxifer cut the Indian force in half, with disastrous consequences for the Comanche. Reed, suddenly aware that his portion of the force faced only a segment of Matark's men, made a frenzied attack at 4 in the morning, encircling Matark's camp, killing many of its inhabitants, and taking the great chief captive. At the same time, Jaxifer invested the other half, and although many escaped his net, he did capture some 36, including Peavine and the 4 white girls he was protecting. With tears of joy, the rattlesnake told his captors of how he had been a peaceful rancher in the vicinity of Fort Griffin, and of how Matark's men, damn them, had overrun the place and taken his 4 granddaughters captive. And while the cavalrymen were celebrating and giving the girls attention, he made his quiet escape with 3 of their best horses. When Reed learned that Jaxifer had also been successful, he dispatched a scout to inform Mackenzie of his unqualified success, including the rescue of the 4 white girls. But it was not till after the horsemen had ridden north that he began interrogating his black troops about the details of their splendid victory, and heard about the elderly white man who had delivered the girls. "You mean," he asked with a sick feeling, "that the old man had a withered left arm?" "Yes, he did." Knowing what his next answer would be, he asked the girls, "Did the old man bring guns for the Indians?" And when they said that he had, but that he had also been extremely protective of them, he asked, "Did the Indians call him Little Cripple?" And when they nodded, he jumped up and began kicking a saddle. "Good God, Sergeant Jaxifer, you had Rattlesnake Peavine in your hands and you let him go." And right there, the Fort Garner detachment, all 100 of them, and the 4 girls, entered into a compact. "We need tell no one about Amos Peavine. Girls, he saved your lives, didn't he? So keep quiet about him. Men, do you want the rest of the army laughing at you? Say nothing." He himself did not feel obligated to report more than the bare facts. Sergeant Jaxifer and his well-disciplined detachment of 10th Cavalry routed the other half of Matark's force, and in doing so gallantly rescued 4 white girls who had been held prisoner by the Comanche. Matark was taken, as the peace policy required, to Camp Hope, where he was turned over to new Quakers who had replaced the unfortunate Earnshaw Rusk. He was then moved to a remote reservation in Florida, from which he launched a barrage of appeals. 2 Quaker agents new to the frontier lodged a thoughtful appeal for clemency on the grounds that Chief Matark was at heart a well-intentioned man caught up in the tragedy of a war of extermination. President Grant was touched by this reasoning, and remembering with what high hopes he had launched his Indian policy, told an aide, "What does that fellow Rusk from Pennsylvania say about Matark?" And when Earnshaw was invited to make a report, he reflected on all he knew about Matark, and then he prayed. After 2 days of soul-searching, he drafted this response. "I have known Matark for many years. He is a savage, striving to find his way in a new civilization governed by new rules which he cannot comprehend. I believe I know every evil thing he has done, and I condemn him for his barbarities. But I assure thee, Mr. President, that except for torture, which can never be forgiven, he has committed no act more reprehensible than what the United States Army committed against him and his people. His tragedy was that he was never given the option of accepting a consistent peace policy offered in good faith by the American government. And to punish him now for fighting according to rules established by our side is deplorable. I have searched my heart to determine what is justice in this affair, and I find I must beg thee to commute his sentence. He is, like thee, an honorable warrior. Allow him to return to his people and to the lands he used to roam." He was pardoned with the stern admonition, "If you ever set foot in Texas, you will be shot on sight." To which he replied with humility, "I no want Texas." Because the temptation to reinvade Texas might prove irresistible if he was lodged at Camp Hope, from where the traditional hunting grounds would be visible each dawn, he was moved to another section of the Indian Territory. And there, a woman reporter for a Texas newspaper found him after peace had been established on the plains. Chief Matark can be considered with much reason one of the last Indians who warred in Texas. Of all the hundreds of thousands who terrorized our ranches, he was the last. And when I found him sitting peacefully beside an arroyo on his reservation, I asked him what his lasting memories were of our state. And he said, "Texas, that was the best." 2 weeks after this interview was published in the Texas papers, Matark quietly disappeared from the reservation, and the Quaker in charge of the area announced, "He knew he was dying, and went, as is the custom of his people, to some lonely spot where he could rejoin the Great Spirit." He had actually gone west across the border into New Mexico in response to a smuggled appeal from Amos Peavine, and there he had joined forces with his old comrade, robbing stagecoaches and caravans headed for California. Numerous agitated reports reached Santa Fe and Tucson of this murderous duo who appeared suddenly at the bend of a road. There was this old man with a withered left arm, this big Indian who said nothing. They took everything. There were also reports, more ominous, of what happened when the travelers had tried to resist. The white man was so quick on the trigger, he shot two of our men before anyone knew what was happening. The depredations became so offensive that posses were organized, both in New Mexico and Arizona, and on a blazingly hot August afternoon in the latter state, a gun battle erupted, and when it ended, Chief Matark of the Comanche, not yet 50 years old, lay dead on the burning sand. What happened to Amos Peavine was less certain. Said the coroner in reporting his inquest, he was last seen headed north, trailing blood. Considering the land into which he disappeared, he must be listed as dead. Now came one of the curiosities of Texas history. The Comanche threat having been contained, there was no further use for a frontier post like Fort Sam Garner, and so one day in October 1874, George Reed, who had built it of mud back in 1869 and converted it to stone by 1871, received curt instructions from Lewis Renfro in Washington. Captain George Reed, Company T, 14th Infantry, Commanding Officer, Fort Garner, Texas. You will proceed immediately to the abandonment of Fort Garner on Bear Creek, dismantling such buildings as can be torn down, and returning the land to its civilian owners without any obligation on our part to restore its original condition or make compensation. Obedient to the orders, Reed assembled his men and informed them that the two companies of the 10th Cavalry would be reassigned to Colonel McKenzie at Fort Sill, while the two companies of the 14th Infantry under Captain Wetzel would remain at Fort Garner to decommission the post. On a bright morning, the two young officers who had replaced Johnny Miner lost his left leg in the battle at Three Cairns, and Jim Logan, dead from the shooting at the tank, flashed hand signals to John Jaxifer, who blew his whistle and headed his Negro cavalry back toward Jacksboro. As Jaxifer left the parade ground for the last time, Wetzel stopped him to say, with grudging admiration, "You were first class, Jaxifer. Your men, they're beginning to learn." Jaxifer looked back to review his men, saddles polished, boots pipe-clayed, brass gleaming, faces smiling. He was proud of these dark men, for he knew that rarely had a military unit performed more bravely, more consistently, and with so little recognition. When they vanished in dust, Wetzel's infantrymen began the task of emptying the buildings, loading the wagons, and demolishing the few wooden structures. The stout stone buildings they did not touch, for these were now the property of an unusual owner who gave every intention of occupying them far into the future. After careful investigation, Reed had satisfied himself that the legal arrangement which his wife had finally engineered in favor of Emma Larkin still prevailed. "If I understand you, Judge, the land on which Fort Garner stands reverts to the Larkin girl." "It does, and she owns the 6,000 other acres we awarded her." "Then, by Texas law, she gets all the buildings we erected?" "She does. You know that in Texas, the federal government does not own public lands." In a quiet ceremony at the fort, which the judge attended, Reed turned the property over to Emma. "You've been a brave woman. You've earned this land. Occupy it in honor." He kissed her, as did Wetzel. But the judge whispered to Sanders, "Small reward. The buildings are worth nothing. The land, maybe 10 cents an acre." While the men were still dismantling the fort, a general of extraordinary charm sent notice that he intended visiting the fort with the next wagon train, and preparations were made in the diminished quarters to receive him properly. "What can we do?" Mrs. Reed protested. "Things half-packed. He'll think we're slovens." When the general arrived, a big, fleshy man with European manners, he put the wives at ease. "My wife and I were warned that you were closing down. That's why we hurried." And from his wagon he produced hampers of food, enough for all the troops. He was General Yancey Quimper, 62 years old, hero not only of San Jacinto, but now of Monterrey as well, and as always, a soldier whose first thought was for the welfare of his men. "Feed the troops, Captain Reed, and while they feast, let me explain why we've come so far to pay you honor." He personally broke open the hampers of beef and duck, arranging a separate table for the four black cavalrymen left behind as guards, and while they toasted him in beer from the two barrels he provided, he told the Reeds and the Wetzels, "This gracious lady who stands at my side is none other than the widow of Captain Sam Garner, for whom your fort was named. And those two fine men slicing the beef were Garner's sons. They're mine now, for I adopted them, and they bear the name of Quimper." He said this grandiloquently, as if by taking away the honorable name of Garner and bestowing upon them the dubious one of Quimper, he had somehow conferred dignity. "And that stalwart, opening the beer keg, is my birth son James, who merits congratulations, for last week he became a father." Mrs. Quimper, a gracious lady who said little, leaving explanations to her voluble husband, did slip in a word. "The general thought it would be proper for us to pay our respects to the fort before it was abandoned." And her husband broke in, "I'll wager you've seen a lot of action here." His lively hands imitated the thrust and parry of cavalry actions. He made a favorable impression on Wetzel, who said at the conclusion of Quimper's explanation of how his troops had managed the two mountains at Monterey, "General, you have a better understanding of uphill attack than anyone I've met in America." To which Quimper replied, "It comes from study and experience." He also explained how the Texas troops had managed to hold the Lunette at Vicksburg, which was a very ugly show, I can tell you. Mrs. Reed, who followed military conversations closely, realized that Quimper never claimed that he had actually been at either Monterey or Vicksburg, and she was about to query this point when the general delighted everyone by announcing that he had brought a surprise for the commanding officer of our Garner Fort. And after a signal to one of his sons, a large package was brought in and delivered to Reed. "Open it, sir," Quimper cried. "Open it so we can see." And when Reed did, out came a pair of glistening military boots, fawn-colored and decorated with embossed eagles, swords, and the word Texas in silver. "They're genuine Quimpers," Yancey said. "Fightin' boots for fightin' men, and it's a privilege to deliver them to the commander of our fort." "But how did you get my size?" "Aha! Did you, by chance, miss a pair of your old army boots?" Reed looked at his wife, who shrugged her shoulders. "Don't stare at her," Yancey bellowed. "It was him." And he pointed at Wetzel, who confessed that 5 months ago he had purloined the boots in order to make this happy occasion possible. On the next day, Quimper disclosed his purpose in coming so far. He asked to see the girl Emma Larkin, and when she was produced, he spoke directly. "I should like to purchase the land which the courts have awarded you." "The courts awarded me nothing," Emma said, staring at him. "I've always owned it. My parents patented it in 1869. "Yes, but since you were a minor and an orphan, the courts..." "They gave me nothing," she repeated. And it was obvious that Quimper was not going to have an easy time with this young woman. "You have 6,000 acres, más o menos, as we say in old Mexico, more or less. Why would you wish to buy?" "We have a saying, if you acquire enough land in Texas, something good will surely happen. With the money I give you, you can live easily in town somewhere." He explained that he was prepared to offer 10 cents an acre, slightly above the going rate. "That would mean $600, and you could do wonders with $600. When she said no, he raised his bid to 12 cents, and when she still refused, he said, "Because of the heroism of your family, 12.5 cents. That's $750, a princely sum for a young girl like you." But as the evening closed, she was still refusing. When she returned to the Wetzel quarters, the others argued with her, telling her that with $750 she could buy a good house in Jacksboro and learn to sew or help in other ways. It never occurred to them or her that she might one day marry or even have children. She would always be a homeless waif, and they wished for her own good to see her settled. "We'll be leaving in a few days, you know. You certainly can't live alone in a great empty fort like this, even if you do own it." But she would not consent. In the morning, the Quimpers, the Wetzels, and the Reeds combined to try to make her see the advisability of accepting the general's offer, but she rebuffed them. "This is the land my father settled. My whole family paid a terrible price for it. I paid a terrible price. And I will not surrender it, not even if I have to live here with coyotes." Nothing could be said to dislodge her, and she was dismissed, as if she were 7 instead of 17. When she was gone, Reed asked Quimper if he would like to see the fort as it had functioned in its glory years. And when Yancey said with pomp, "I would appreciate seeing how our fort operated," off they went, taking the Quimper sons with them. Mrs. Reed and Mrs. Wetzel were left to entertain Mrs. Quimper, and this was a pleasing arrangement, for it gave the fort women a chance to clarify certain obscurities. Louise Reed started the questions. "I wasn't aware that your husband had been at Monterey, your present husband, that is." Bertha Wetzel broke in. "Of course we knew about your first husband, a great hero. We had a pamphlet to educate the troops about the man for whom their fort was named." Mrs. Quimper was eager to talk once more with military wives who understood the intricacies of a soldier's life. "When General Quimper married me, and I was most gratified to find a man so gentle and so helpful. You've seen my first two sons. They were on their way to becoming little ruffians when he stepped in to make men of them. I'll be forever grateful." "You were saying that when you married—" Mrs. Reed rarely allowed a visitor to leave a thought unfinished. "Looking back, I can now see that he was a big, formless man with no character. But when he married me, he found himself with a ready-made character, my husband's. He began to dress like him, speak like him. He stood straighter, learned military talk. He took my sons and gave them his name. And soon he was talking incessantly about Sam Garner's exploits in Monterey. But soon it was our exploits, and before long, my exploits. One night I heard him explain to a group of generals how he had charged the bishop's palace atop that Monterey hill. He had also been very brave at Vicksburg. He adopted me and my sons and my dead husband's military career." She held her palms up and smiled. "So he is now both my first husband and my second." "But he did this from a solid foundation," Mrs. Reed suggested, "San Jacinto and all." Mrs. Quimper laughed. "Right after the battle, my first husband told me about Quimper and his capture of Santa Ana. The poor Mexican was hiding in the bushes. His ragged clothing made Yancey think he was a mere peon, but they took him in and only later learned who he was." "With such behavior," Mrs. Wetzel asked, "how did he become a general?" "Very simple. One day he announced to the world, 'I am a general.' And Texas was so hungry for heroes, they allowed him to be a general." Mrs. Reed poured Mrs. Quimper a second cup of tea, then said very quietly, "Have you heard about Louis Renfro's heroic rescue of that young woman you just saw, the Larkin girl?" "Everybody's heard. Texas papers were filled with little else." "The same." Mrs. Quimper looked first at Mrs. Reed, who was smiling, then at Mrs. Wetzel, who was laughing outright. And their humor was so infectious that she had to smile, even though she did not yet understand the reason. "You mean—" She fumbled for a word that would not be too condemnatory of her husband. "That he was also a gentle fraud?" Now Mrs. Wetzel could not contain herself. "This wonderful colored soldier, no neck, could fight anyone. He rescued Emma Larkin from 6 Comanche." She collapsed in laughter. "Yes," Mrs. Reed said. "Our very brave cavalry sergeant did just that." Mrs. Wetzel told the rest. So then our hero, Louis Renfro, commander-in-chief of desk forces, he rides up, recognizes the girl, grabs her, and grabs the glory. The three women chuckled at the follies of the self-appointed heroes whose antics they had observed. And when Mrs. Wetzel began to gasp for air, the other two broke into very unladylike guffaws. When the Quimpers departed, with Yancey pleased at having seen his fort, but dismayed by his failure to acquire the land, Mrs. Reed resumed the task of closing down the post. And as she moved from building to building, she saw many things to remind her of the good work she had done in transforming this lonely outpost into a haven of civilization. In this stone building, she had organized the social teas for each new wife. In a corner of that building, she had arranged for everyone to place his extra books so that a library might be started. In this small garden, fertilized with manure from the stables, she had grown flowers for the hospital. And in the deadhouse, she had made the disfigured corpses acceptable before their friends or families saw them. In the chapel, she had persuaded her husband to conduct prayers when there was no regular chaplain. And on Sud's Row, she had helped when babies had the croup. Most important, she had been the guiding spirit in converting this mud outpost into a square-cornered fort of limestone. It had lasted, in its complete form, only 3 years. But she resolved that if her husband was now assigned to a newly established fort, probably some leagues to the west where the settlers were probing, she would encourage him to build of stone from the start. "We live in any place only briefly, George. They may laugh and ask us as we depart, 'Why did you take the trouble to build of stone?' If they don't understand that this was the home of 200 soldiers, I'll not be able to explain." She did not weep as they departed, but she did keep looking backward until Bear Creek disappeared, and the Brazos, and the tops of the buildings at the fort. And she kept doing so until only the vast plains and its endless blue sky were visible. These eventful days had been difficult for Earnshaw Rusk, for the army despised him as a dreamer who refused to look facts in the face, and his own Quakers deplored him as a traitor who in panic had called in the soldiers to settle a temporary difficulty that could have been handled by negotiation. After his expulsion, in disgrace, from Camp Hope, he had tried living for a while at Jacksboro, but that robust settlement, where men resolved arguments with guns and fists, provided no place for a man like him. He had also tried the town that had grown up at the edges of Fort Griffin to the south, but that was a true hellhole whose shenanigans terrified him. Then he served as a night nurse in a field hospital at another fort, where his behavior at Camp Hope was not known. And now, when he heard that Fort Garner was being disbanded, he came back to the scene of his humiliation. He went, as he had long planned in his confused imagination, to the house once occupied by Captain Wetzel and his wife. And there he found Emma Larkin, working alone, as if she were living safely in the heart of some small town. She seemed adjusted to the problem of living without ears or nose. And when, after the first awkward greetings, he asked where she would make her home, she replied in her soft whisper, "Here, at the fort. I like it, and it's mine." He accepted the tea she offered him in a cup left behind by the Wetzels, and she showed him how she had collected quite a few household items from the other departing officers. "I'll live." Sitting in the chair that was once Wetzel's favorite, he began his awkward speech. "Emma, I've made a terrible mess of my life." He did not say it, but she knew he intended to say, "And thee has made a mess of thine," or "other people made a mess for thee." Instead, he plowed on. "And I have been wondering..." He stopped. From that first day when he met this pitiful child, he had speculated on what might happen to her. How could a human being so abused survive? How could she face the world? It was out of such wonderment that he had been impelled to carve the nose which she now wore. It had not been because of love, for he had no comprehension of that word, and little understanding of the complex emotions it represented. But it was out of concern and caring. And he was caring now. "I've been wondering what thee would do with thy protectors gone." By this use of an inappropriate word, for this young woman required no protectors, he betrayed his line of reasoning. "And I've thought..." He could not go on. Nothing in his lonely, bungling life had prepared him to speak the words that should be spoken now. Emma Larkin, damaged and renewed as few humans would ever be, reached out, touched his hand, and used his first name for the first time. "Earnshaw, I've been given this land, these buildings. I will need someone to help me." "Could I be thy helper?" he managed to stammer. "Thee could, Earnshaw," she whispered. "Thee could indeed." Task Force. It was midsummer in Austin, and heat lay over the city like an oppressive blanket, which intercepted oxygen and brought blazing discomfort. Day after day, the temperature hovered close to 100 degrees, as a cloudless sky glared down like the inside of a superheated bronze bowl. Fish in the lovely lake kept toward the bottom, where the sun's incessant beating was lessened, if not escaped. And in the countryside, torpid cattle sought any vestige of shade. It could be hot in Texas, and all who could afford it fled to New Mexico. Despite the heat, we were scheduled to hold our July meeting in Beaumont, the famous oil city near the Gulf, where we hoped optimistically there might be breezes. I anticipated a productive meeting, since we were to be addressed by Professor Garvey Jaxifer from Red River State College. My staff assured me that he was not inflammatory, only persistent, and I told them, "Persistence after truth we can live with," so the meeting was arranged. I was therefore disturbed when Rusk and Quimper called me on a conference line to ask that I convene an extraordinary 2-day meeting prior to Beaumont. I supposed they were going to protest my invitation to Professor Jaxifer, but they assured me that this was not their concern. Rusk growled, "I've heard the man twice, here in Fort Worth. If he knew figures, I'd hire him. Solid citizen." What the improvised meeting was to discuss, I could not guess. But at 9 one steamy morning, Miss Cobb, Professor Garza, and I assembled at Austin's Browning Airport for private planes and watched as 2 jets landed in swift succession. As they taxied toward us, I wondered why 2 were needed. But when the first opened its doors, I saw that Lorenzo Quimper had picked up our 3 staffers from Dallas, so apparently it was going to be an important session. The conspirators would not tell us where we were going, but shortly we were flying northwest on a route which would take us, I calculated, over Abilene and Lubbock. "What's this all about?" I asked Quimper, who rode in my plane, and he winked. I guessed that we were going to hold a preliminary session of some kind in a place like Amarillo, but when we had reached that general area and gave no sign of descending, I knew we must be entering New Mexico. After Quimper served us a choice of drinks and Danish, we began to descend. And soon one of the young men, a better geographer than I, shouted, "Hey, Santa Fe!" Flying low, so that we could see the grandest city of the Southwest, we swung north along the highway to Taos, circled a large ranch, and landed on a private strip, macadamized and 6,000 feet long. "Ransom's Hacienda," Quimper announced. And when we joined the others on the tarmac, Rusk said, almost apologetically, "Il Magnifico and I, we thought Texas was just too damned hot. I want you to enjoy 2 days of relaxation. Anything you'd like to do. The helicopters here, riding horses, swimming, great mountain trails, Taos up that way, Santa Fe down there." It was the kind of gesture the very rich in Texas liked to make. But I noticed that everything about the place was low-key. Ford pickups with gun racks behind the driver's head, not Mercedes. Rough bunkhouses with Hudson's Bay blankets for cold nights. And no Olympic-sized swimming pool, just a small, friendly dipping place in which the girl from SMU was going to look just great, because even if she hadn't brought a swimsuit, Rusk's Mexican housekeeper could offer her a choice of 6 or 7. It was a splendid break in the heat, for the Rusk Ranch was 6,283 feet high, with magnificent views of mountains higher than 12,000. But the emotional part of our visit, and I use that word with fondest memories, came at dusk on that first day, when Quimper signaled his chief pilot to bring before us, as we sat by the pool drinking juleps, 4 rather long boxes wrapped in gift paper. "Working with you characters," Lorenzo said, "has been both an education and a privilege. Never knew I could get along so amiably with anarchists." Bowing to Garza, he said, "On this happy occasion, I cannot refrain from sharing my latest Aggie joke. Seems your aviation experts have invented a new type of parachute. Opens on impact." "I'm walking home," Garza said, whereupon Lorenzo grabbed him. "I thought you might, so I brought you just the thing for hiking." Shuffling the 4 parcels, he selected one and handed it to Rusk, who tore off the paper to disclose a long shoebox, inside which rested a pair of incredibly ornate boots. Products of the workmen at the General Quimper Boot Factory, they had been especially orchestrated. With the front showing a bull of the Texas Longhorn breed Rusk was striving to perpetuate on his Larkin County ranch, the side offering one of his oil derricks, and the back of the boot a fine version of his Learjet in blue and gold. The retail cost of such masterpieces I did not care to guess, but I remembered a catalog that had offered lesser boots at $3,000. We were still awed by Rusk's gift when Miss Cobb opened hers to reveal a tall, slim pair ideally suited to her grave demeanor. They were silver and gray, with not a bit of ornamentation to detract from the exquisite patterning of the leather itself. It seemed to have been sculpted in 11 subtle shades of gray. "What kind of leather?" the young woman from SMU cried. And Quimper replied with obvious pride in his men's workmanship, "Amazon boa constrictor." They were once-in-a-lifetime boots. And Miss Cobb was so touched by Lorenzo's gesture that she did not allow herself to speak, lest she behave in a sentimental manner ill-befitting her Cobb ancestry. Now it was my turn, and I could not imagine what Lorenzo had deemed proper for a man with few distinguishing characteristics. But when I opened my box, it was apparent that he had gone back to my honored ancestor, Moses Barlow of the Alamo. For across the top rims of my boots, in flaming red letters against a pale blue background, ran the word Alamo. And beneath it, in green and white leatherwork, stood a depiction of the famous building. Reaching from the sole of the shoe to the top, along the outer flank of each boot, rested a Kentucky long rifle in black. My boots were pure Texas, and I was glad to have them, for with my own funds I could never have afforded such perfection. Because of the incipient animosity between Quimper and Garza, rarely overt but never buried, I had to wonder what Lorenzo would do to catch the professor's personality. But when Efrain opened his box, we gasped, because for him, Quimper had saved his maximum artistry. In a wild flash of red, green, and white, the colors of Mexico's flag, he had provided a peon in a big hat sleeping beside an adobe wall, a depiction of the shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and an intricate enlargement of the central design of the flag, the famous eagle killing a rattlesnake while perched on a cactus. Referring proudly to the latter, Quimper said, "I had my best workman do the vulture eating the worm." And Garza looked up with a mixture of affection and sheer bewilderment. For more than 200 years, his family had had no permanent affiliation with Mexico. He had traveled within that nation only once, and then not pleasantly. And although he spoke its language and followed its religion, he felt no close association with the country. Yet here he was, with boots that proclaimed him loudly to be a Mexican. "Lorenzo," he said, with obvious gratitude, "I think I can speak for us all. You are magnificent." Our three staff members, who had watched the unveiling of our boots, cheered. But now Quimper signaled his other pilot, who came forward with three boxes. When the young people realized that these must be for them, the two young men clapped hands, and the girl from SMU squealed. And the highlight of the ceremony was when she opened her box, for Lorenzo had brought her a pair equal to Miss Cobb's in femininity, but precisely the kind a young woman would appreciate. They were tall and slender, with heels well undercut, and uppers made of a soft red leather that seemed to shout, "I'm 23 and unmarried." The simple decoration was in shining black, and the total effect was one of youthfulness, dancing, and an invitation to flirtation. Miss Cobb said, "Every young woman should know what it's like to own a pair of boots like that." And the recipient began to cry. The two men received simple cowboy boots made of valuable leather, adorned by big hats, lariats, and revolvers. And when the seven pairs were set side by side on the floor, we applauded. But Lorenzo rarely did things partially, for now the chief pilot came in with a box for the boss. And as we cheered, Quimper revealed his own fantastic boots. Basically, they were a wild purple, but in their lighter leathers they contained a summary of Texan culture. A saucy roadrunner yakking across the desert, a Colt's pistol, an oil well, a coiled rattlesnake. "I like my boots to make a statement," Quimper said, and Garza responded, "Those can be heard on the borders of California." And that night, when we stepped from the front door of the ranch on our way to dinner at a Santa Fe restaurant, we were what Quimper called a splendiferous task force. At dinner, Quimper dominated conversation by expounding, in a voice loud enough to be heard at nearby tables, his theory that Santa Fe should have been a part of Texas. "The day will come when Texas patriots will muster an expedition to recapture this town. Then we'll have Texas as it should be, Santa Fe at one end, Houston at the other." When we left the restaurant, we found our evening somewhat dampened by a sign plastered across our windshield. "Texans go home," which reminded us that New Mexicans regard the Texans who flood their towns in summer the way Texans regard the visitors from Michigan who invade their state in winter. Refreshed by this escape from the Texan inferno, we prepared for our forthcoming meeting in Beaumont, where we met Professor Garvey Jaxifer, a sophisticated black scholar. The newspapers usually referred to him as Harvey Jaxifer, unaware that he had been named after the incendiary Jamaican black Marcus Garvey, who had lectured American blacks about their destiny and their rights. That first Garvey had been deported, I believe, but had left behind a sterling reputation as a fighter. And our professor was no less an agitator than his namesake. He presented a short, no-compromise paper, whose highlights follow. Throughout their history, Anglo-Texans have despised Indians, Mexicans, and blacks. This tradition started with the Spanish conquistadores, who saw their Indians as slaves and treated them abominably. This attitude was intensified by any Mexicans who were not classified as Indians themselves. We have seen how in 1836, General Santa Anna had no compunction about marching his barefoot, thinly clad Yucatecan Indians into the face of a blizzard, losing more than half through freezing to death. The early Texians inherited this contempt for the Indian, strengthened by understandable prejudices engendered in frontier states like Kentucky and Tennessee, where warfare with the Indian had been a common experience. But it was fortified in Texas by the fact that many of the Indian tribes encountered by the early settlers were extremely difficult people. The cannibalistic Karankawa, the remorseless Waco, and the savage Kiowa. The earliest Americans had to fight such Indians for every foot of ground they occupied. And this blinded them to the positive aspects of the other Indians they encountered, especially the Cherokee. Later, of course, the Texians met face to face with the fearful Apache and Comanche. And with the most generous intentions in the world, it would have been difficult to find any solution to the clash which then occurred. No outsider, ignorant of the bloody history of the 1850 to 1875 frontier, with its endless massacres and hideous tortures, has a right to condemn the Texas settlers for the manner in which they responded. But Texas lost a great deal when it expelled its Indians, and the debt is only now being collected. For one thing, the state lost a group of people who could have contributed to our wonderful diversity had they remained. But much more important, their expulsion encouraged the Texian to believe that he truly was supreme, lord of all he surveyed, and that he could order lesser peoples around as he wished. The Indian was long gone when the real tragedy of his departure began to be felt, because the Texian diverted his wrath from the Indian to the Mexican and the black, and the scars of this transferal are with us to this day. I am assured that previous scholars have spoken of the heavy burden Texas bears because of its refusal to adjust to the Mexican problem, so I shall drop that subject. I shall restrict myself solely to the way in which Texas has handled its black problem, and because my allotted time is short, I shall address you shortly, sharply, and without that body of substantiating material I would normally offer. The condition of the black in Texas is one of the great secrets of Texas history, which has been written almost as if the blacks had never existed. Yet in 1860, blacks constituted 31% of the population and represented a total tax value of over $122 million. They vastly outnumbered either the Mexicans or the Indians, and the economy of the state, dominated by cotton, depended largely upon them. Despite vast evidence to the contrary, two legends grew up around the blacks, one before the Civil War, one after. And these legends were so persuasive, so consoling to the Texas whites, that they are not only honored today, but also believed. They continue to affect all relations between the two races. The antebellum legend is that the slaves were happy in their servitude, that they did not seek freedom, and that they did not warrant it because they had no skills other than chopping cotton and could not possibly have existed without white supervision. The facts were somewhat different. On most plantations, slaves were the master mechanics. They were nurses of extraordinary skill and compassion. They were also custodians of the land, and many saved enough money to buy their own freedom. Properly encouraged and utilized, they could have earned Texas far more as mechanics than they did through cotton. But the perplexing part of the legend was that while the slaves were supposed to be happy under the compassionate tutelage of their white masters, Texas newspapers were filled with rumors of slave uprisings, of slaves burning the masters' barns, and of general insurrection. Scores of county histories tell of executions of slaves to forestall rebellion, and slave flight to Mexico became so common that from time to time agents were stationed along the border to prevent it. I can speak of this with some authority, because my great-great-grandfather used that route to escape from his slavery on the plantation of your ancestors, Miss Cobb, where, I hasten to add, he told his children that he had been well-treated. But once he got the chance, over the Rio Grande into Mexico. "What did he do when he got there?" Quimper asked. And Jaxifer replied, "Made his way to Veracruz, caught a ship to New Orleans, where he enlisted in a New York regiment." "You mean he fought with the North?" Quimper grumbled. And Jaxifer asked, "What did you expect?" And Quimper said, "He could have remained neutral." Professor Jaxifer continued, "The Texians found no difficulty in believing both halves of this antebellum legend, that the same slave was deliriously happy, yet thirsting to massacre his master." The postbellum legend was more destructive. The genesis was understandable. The South had been defeated. The North, especially under President Lincoln, wanted to be generous in its treatment. But his assassination opened the way for some radicals in Congress to force upon the South an intolerable reconstruction. One of the ironies of Texas history is that its newspapers and its people rejoiced when Lincoln was shot, condemning him as one of the supreme tyrants of all time, not realizing that he alone could have enabled their state to avoid the convulsion it was about to suffer. It was 1902 before the first paper was brave enough to print one kind word about Lincoln, and it was abused for having done so. The true history of Reconstruction in Texas has not yet been written, and probably cannot be in this century. The legend of that tempestuous time is still too virulent. Regarding blacks, it makes three claims. That those blacks elected to office under Northern supervision of the ballot box were incompetent at best, downright thieves at the worst. It claims that blacks who suddenly found themselves with freedom did not know what to do with it. And most important, it claims that the occasional black members of the state police installed by the carpetbagger government were brutal murderers. Nothing in the history of Texas has damaged the black more than the fact that a few were, for a while, members of the state police, that hated and reviled agency. Again, the legend is faulty at best, infamous at worst. Black legislators seem to have been no worse than their white contemporaries and successors. Many blacks learned quickly what to do with their freedom and either established their own homes and small businesses or went back to work on the plantations as sharecroppers. And as for the black policemen, if they did, as charged, kill 8 or 10 white men without warrant, the rangers had killed 8 or 10 hundred Mexicans and Indians. Yet the former are reviled, and the latter immortalized. It is a disproportion that cannot easily be explained. Professor Jaxifer then threw in an obiter dictum which really stunned our Texas landlovers. If you suspect I'm overemphasizing the bitterness of Reconstruction, let me cite an incident which you, better than most, will appreciate. In 1868, a Republican-controlled convention, drawing new laws for peacetime Texas, recalled the hardships under which Texans who had fought on the Union side suffered. These patriots were mercilessly slandered in their good names and property. In recompense, they would be issued free land. But it went unclaimed, because in all of land-hungry Texas, no man was brave enough to stand before his neighbors as one who had been false to the Confederacy and no better than a carpetbagger. "You mean," Quimper asked, "that all this free land was waiting and no one claimed it?" When Jaxifer nodded, Lorenzo added, "For a Texan to pass up free land is an act of moral heroism." Jaxifer smiled and continued with these points. The hatreds engendered spawned a curious progeny. Many of the gunslingers of the Old West began by shooting blacks who had given no offense, and such bravado gained them the approbation of their fellows. Billy the Kid started by slaughtering a Negro blacksmith who made a pun upon his name, calling him Billy the Goat. He gained much applause for his quick and deadly response. As one hagiographer has said, a flick of his wrist, a touch of his finger, and Billy silenced forever those thick, black, insolent lips. John Wesley Hardin, a cold-eyed, merciless killer who gunned down 29 men before he was 24, was despised prior to the day when he shot 2 black policemen. Then he found himself a Texas hero. But the prototype of the Texas gunman was Cole Yeager from Sevier County, who announced one day at the age of 18, I cannot abide a freed nigger. He proved it by shooting in the stomach a young black who had argued with an older black. When asked about this, Yeager muttered, The Bible says, Ye shall respect thy elders, and no charges were lodged. Sometime later, he saddled up at dusk in the small town of Lexington, not far from the capital, galloped through the street, and slaughtered 8 unsuspecting blacks. His high spirits were excused on the ground that this was the kind of incident that was bound to happen, sooner or later. Pleased with his reputation as a nigger killer, he was lounging in Jefferson, up in the cotton belt, one Sunday morning, when he saw 2 well-dressed blacks, Trajan Cobb and his wife Pansy, leaving their cottage and heading for the black church. Enraged that former slaves should be trying to be better than they was, Yeager whipped out his guns and killed them. They happened to work as freedmen for Senator Cobb, the one-armed hero of the Confederacy, and when he heard in Washington of what had happened, he returned immediately to Texas, determined to bring Yeager to justice, and with his tiny wife, Petty Prue, he roamed the state looking for the man who had killed his former slaves. Federal marshals, afraid of the scandal which might ensue if Yeager gunned down a one-armed United States senator, tried to dissuade Cobb from stalking his prey, but Cobb would not listen. When a man has affronted the honor of an entire state, he must be taken care of, and if you gentlemen are afraid to go after him, I must. The marshals tried to persuade Mrs. Cobb to call off her man, but she snapped, Trajan Cobb bears our name. He held our plantation together during the war. And if Somerset doesn't shoot the coward who killed him, I will. Fortunately, at about this time, Cole Yeager killed a white man, shot him in the back during an argument over 50 cents, and now the law had a viable excuse for arresting him. Under pressure from Senator Cobb, a fearless judge from Victoria County was brought north, and Yeager, who had now killed 37 men, most of them black, was sentenced to be hanged. The Cobbs were there when the execution took place, and they groaned as the rope broke, allowing Yeager to fall unscathed. Some in the crowd cited an old English tradition which said that under such circumstances the condemned man had to be set free, in that God had intervened. And there were murmurs to support this, for many in the audience felt it was unfair to hang a white man, primarily because he had killed niggers. However, Cobb, with his good right arm, whipped out his revolver and announced, We are not hanging him according to old English law. We are using new Texas law. String the son of a bitch up. And it was done. One of the more interesting illustrations of how difficult it was for Texans to adjust to the freed Negro came in Robertson County, not far from where we sit. A gifted black, Harriel Geiger, had been elected to the state legislature, and during his tenure in Austin had studied law and become a member of the bar. He excelled in defending black prisoners. But this irritated Judge O.D. Cannon of the Robertson bench, who is described in Chronicles as that hot-tempered segregationist. In any trial involving a black, the judge had been in the habit of listening to whatever evidence the white man chose to present. He did not allow any black to testify. Then growling, spitting, and sentencing the black to a long term on the prison workforce. Naturally, he did not take it kindly when lawyer Geiger, with the skills he had mastered as a legislator, came into his court arguing points of law. One hot afternoon, Judge Cannon had suffered enough. I've been warning you to watch your step, nigger, but you have insolently ignored my counsel. With that, he whipped out a long revolver, held it 3 feet from the lawyer's chest, and pulled the trigger 5 times. The coroner's verdict, Harriel Geiger had been guilty of repeated contempt and had been properly rebuked. I agree, there are elements of humor in this incident. The irascible judge, the presumptuous new lawyer, the challenge to old customs, the sullen revenge of the men who had lost a moral crusade in the war between the states. But I have here in my notes, which you are invited to inspect, a score of other incidents which contain no humor at all, and I shall cite only one more to remind you of the seriousness of the problem we are discussing. In 1892, in Paris, Texas, a black man named Henry Smith ravished and killed the 3-year-old daughter of one Henry Vance. No doubt of the crime, no doubt of the guilt, no doubt of the sentence of death. But how was he executed? He was driven in a wagon through a crowd of 10,000, then lashed to a chair perched high upon a cotton sledge, from which Vance, the dead girl's father, asked the horde to be silent while he took his revenge. A small tinner's furnace was brought to Vance, who heated several soldering irons white hot. Taking one after another, he started at the prisoner's bare feet and slowly worked his way up the body, burning off appendages but keeping the torso alive. When he reached the head, he burned out the mouth, then extinguished the eyes and punctured the ears. When he felt sated, he offered the irons to anyone else who wanted to share in the revenge, and his 15-year-old son took over. 10,000 cheered. The black man deserved to die, but no man ever deserved to die in such a manner. It was made possible only because legend said that the black was not really human. It would serve no useful purpose for us to continue to explore the hideous record, for my point is made. Relations between white and black in Texas have been contaminated by legend. I am not asking that you attack the legend or even make a great fuss about it, but do not prolong it. Don't give it added vitality. Let it die. Speak of your Texas blacks as human beings, no better, no worse than the Czechs, the Poles, and the Irish who have helped build this great state. When Professor Jaxifer finished, Lorenzo Quimper said, "Do you expect us to forget how your colored people behaved during Reconstruction? I remember well hearing my father tell how his grandfather, General Yancey Quimper, was accosted by a colored who wanted a pair of boots free. This colored, 6 months from chopping cotton, had been elected to the legislature, and he told my grandfather, I can hear my father's words as he told me. This colored, he said, General, I am a legislator now, and I am entitled to free boots. And my grandfather said, Fremont, you are entitled to a swift kick in the ass. And you know what? That colored had my grandfather arrested. Does this old family legend have any relevance? The professor asked. And I could see Quimper flush, and he said with roiling bitterness, A man in my town, big oil man worth millions, was riding home the other day in his Cadillac. He sees this poor old colored in a broken-down Ford, mending a tire by the side of the road, while 3 strappin' young blacks is sittin' by the side of the road, laughin' at the old man's efforts. My friend stops his Cadillac, gets out in that hot, dusty road, and helps the old man change the tire, while the 3 young bucks sit there laughin' at the both of them. Now, what do you think of that? Commissioner Quimper, that story has been circulating through Texas ever since we've had automobiles. Do you really believe it happened this year to your friend? Well, let me tell you. Don't you see, Commissioner? It's today's legend, 1911 version, updated. We had the makings of a serious confrontation, for Professor Jaxifer showed no signs of backing down. However, Miss Cobb intervened. The story you told, Professor, about my grandfather, and she accented the my heavily, is true. He grieved over the loss of Trajan Cobb so painfully that he had a monument erected to him at Lammermoor, to a trusted friend. Ransom Rusk delivered a judicious opinion, which I allowed to stand as the judgment of our group. Professor, you've honored us with a thoughtful paper. You must be aware, surely, that we cannot revise all of Texas history and correct all imbalances. The best we can do is project an honest course for the future. You could not have stated the case more eloquently, Professor Jaxifer conceded. All we blacks ask is that the legends not be embellished with new additions. The old ones we can never change, at least not in this century.